Our Sunday school series for the auditorium is about the beginning of Israel, Genesis 12 through 50, and we're today looking at a lesson about Joseph, really. Say more about that. We will look at the review for Back to Bethel. That was lesson 8. The wayside of life is crowded with people whose love for God has grown cold. Jacob paid a great price for his partial obedience. The leadership of God does not change because we do not follow it. The good news of the gospel is that we do not have to stay the way we are. During this time, Jacob was living in disobedience to God, and he encountered the wrath of several of his neighbors. Most of God's miracles of protection are behind the scenes of life. Jacob built an altar and led his household to worship God. Understanding who we are will greatly influence the way we behave. There is a Bethel, which means house of God, a house of God moment. There is a Bethel in the life of every believer, the author said. In his grace and mercy, God meets us at our Bethel and leads us in the path of righteousness for his name's sake. The first time Jacob visits a place called Luz, he names it Bethel. Bethel means house of God. The second time he visits there, he names it El Bethel, God of the house of God. He changes his focus up from the place to God, it seems, which is a good thing. The book of Genesis, 50 chapters, nearly a third of the book of Genesis is centered around a man named Joseph. Joseph, he's not Adam, he's not Abraham, he's not Noah, he's not even Isaac or Jacob, but there are more chapters devoted to him and the story around him, although Jacob's included, make really Joseph the centerpiece of a greater part of Genesis, more so than any other person. And it's remarkable because he's not the lineage of Christ. He's not the father of the tribe, although he is blessed with two sons who become equal members of the house of Israel. Manasseh and Ephraim are Joseph's sons, and they get equal status because Joseph gets a double blessing. But they're not the family through which Christ comes. But Joseph really appears on the scene and becomes not only a figure for Israel, but he influences the whole world. He becomes a prime minister of sorts of Egypt. He ascends to the house of Pharaoh in a remarkable fashion. He's one of the best Old Testament pictures of Christ. We're not given to know any of the faults that Joseph had. We know he wasn't perfect, but Joseph as a type of Christ is absolutely marvelous. His father's favorite, sold for 30 pieces of silver, is rejected and then is later exalted. He offers bread for the world. Jesus is the bread of life. At one time I saw a list of 38 points of illustration in Joseph's life that remind us of Jesus. And so when we look at the beginning of Israel, this man Joseph is pivotal, because when Joseph brings his family to Egypt, there are only about 70 of them. Because of Joseph's place in the Egyptian empire, Israel is allowed to grow into a nation of some 2 or 3 million people. Now, at the beginning of Exodus, they will be enslaved. But that's because they became so numerous and they were so blessed, and God was blessing them, and the Egyptians enslaved them. But Joseph is the one who brings Israel in from a time of famine. They survive because of Joseph's foresight. And then Joseph leaves instructions that when they leave, He prophesies the Exodus. He says, you take my bones with you. They moved his body with them to the promised land. This lesson looks at chapters 36 through 38, Joseph and his brothers. The advantage I have is this is very familiar to every faithful Bible reader. From Sunday school as a child, you probably remember Joseph's coat of many colors and the conflict that he has with his brothers. And that conflict will foreshadow the restoration of Joseph and his brothers later on. It's not a spoiler alert. You know that their desire to destroy Joseph is defeated. And Potiphar's wife tries to destroy Joseph. That's also defeated. And Joseph will actually go from the prison to the prime ministry. And later will be reunited with his brothers and his father in a remarkable picture of restoration and reconciliation. Genesis 37:4 says, when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. The student will appreciate that God will care for his own, although things may get worse before they get better. Well, that's a cheery thought. Sometimes things get worse before they get better. That was certainly true of Joseph's life. From his dreams of exaltation to being sold into slavery to being falsely accused of rape and great crime. And he is in prison. And then finally God puts him on higher ground. See, dangerous partiality, verses 3 and 4 of chapter 37. A dangerous revelation, those are Joseph's dreams, verses 5 through 10. And then dangerous behavior. Genesis 37, verse 3. Now Israel, remember that's Jacob's new name. He was cheater, supplanter. God changed his name to Israel, and now the Bible refers to him often as Israel. Israel loved Joseph. Joseph and Benjamin were Rachel's children, natural children, and he had a favorite. It turns out later, Benjamin actually, when Joseph, of course, is taken away from Israel, Benjamin becomes probably not only the youngest, but also the favorite son. But he loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. Now, I've read some conjecture about this coat. You've probably seen artist depiction of it. You probably colored one for him when you were a child. You probably had to color Joseph's, not in the adult class, but you know, in another class you may have done that. You probably colored Joseph's coat of many colors. And I've read different descriptions of what that may have meant. Now, it would not have been like Dolly Parton's coat of many colors, which was sort of like a ragamuffin. Does anybody know that song? It's not the same story, but that was just sort of a patchwork quilt of bits and pieces of clothing kind of sewn together out of poverty. Joseph's coat, not like Dolly's coat. It was extravagant. It was probably the fabric and the dyes to make Joseph's coat would have been very, very expensive. It wasn't something that Joseph kind of, you know, stitched together some afternoon out of the rag box. This would have been splendid. It would have been one writer said, maybe a little bit on the gaudy side, maybe just a little extravagant, but the finest materials, the finest colors. The Bible talks about the trade route that the king's highway that came up from the you know, Israel or Palestine. Canaan was the land bridge between Africa and Europe, and Asia, and there was a trade route there, and there were they brought materials, exotic materials, dyes, and so it would have been at some expense. Jacob, of course, was wealthy. He had crops and flocks, so he had the wherewithal to do it, but seems to have bestowed a great deal of wealth on Joseph. And his brothers saw it. Now, I've heard all kinds of messages about how unwise this was, and even the author of our curriculum goes, how terrible it is for a parent to show that kind of partiality. And I agree with that. But then again, I have to confess something to you. You can believe this or not. I do not have a favorite child. I don't know how that would be. Now, if you have a favorite child, don't tell anybody. Don't give them try to keep that under your hat. But I'm not being pious here. I really don't have a favorite child. At any given moment, some of them better than the other. No, but that's not the same thing. Because I do think I love all my children the same. Somebody nod your head and say, that's sort of how I feel about it. I can't sympathize with Jacob. I can't say, well, I really wanted to spoil this one, but now you say, well, maybe people think you did have a favorite child. Well, then of course that'd be another problem. But I, in my heart, I don't really have that. I don't have that entrapment. Jacob, poor old Jacob. He, in spite of himself, God blesses him. But Jacob created all those scenarios, all that drama, all that soap opera around his children. Jacob helped create that. And it is what it is. Jacob loved Joseph more than all his children. And a second mistake, one writer said, Jacob doesn't seem to understand that the other sons are outraged. How could you be so oblivious not to know that the other sons were offended by that? Offended to the point of what later happens here when they want to kill Joseph. If he really loved Joseph, he should have been paying attention. He should have said, I love Joseph, but what effect will this have on his brothers? So, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. Jacob must have known about this. It must have been known, or unless he was just blissfully ignorant of it. Joseph dreamed a dream. And Joseph is an Old Testament prophet. And he dreams a dream. And one of the ways that God spoke in the before the completion of the Old and New Testament canon, he would sometimes reveal truth in dreams. Don't confuse this with Joseph, the guardian of Jesus in the New Testament. God also spoke to him in a dream. But Joseph dreamed a dream, and it was from God, and he told his brethren. Again, one writer criticized Joseph for this, but if this is God speaking to Joseph, this is not Joseph's fault that they hate him for this reason. He said unto them, "Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field." When you cut the wheat, you bind it up, stack it up. "Lo, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaf stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf." So, my sheaf standing upright, and you all bowed down to me. Just what they wanted to hear. Just the words that these brothers wanted to hear. And his brothers said to him, "Shalt thou indeed reign over us?" Foreshadowing here, one day he will reign over them. And I'll tell you something else, they will be glad that he does. There will come a point when they are so hungry and they are so poor they will gladly fall at Joseph's feet. Just read the rest of the book. Read the book of Genesis. His brothers will eventually come, fearful that he may kill them when he reveals himself to them. They don't want to hear it. Shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. So you have this cauldron. They already hate him because he's the favorite. And then his father gives him a coat, an extravagant, expensive coat. They hate him more. Then Joseph tells them his dreams, and I mean their anger is white hot. They are. You say, how could they do such a thing? Well, they're so angry. They couldn't speak peaceably to him. Then he sees another dream. It told his brethren, say, behold, I have a dream to dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him, said unto him, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth? Yes. But you say, why did Joseph keep repeating these dreams? Well, because they were from God. And they are, humanly speaking, they are the catalyst. I'll say this reverently. God has to get Joseph to Egypt. Couldn't there have been another way? Couldn't Joseph just run away from home and join the circus going to Egypt or something? Why this uproar? Why this extravagance? Well, God often uses the wrath of man. He causes the wrath of man to praise him. Acts 2:23 says that the wicked hands of men crucified Jesus, but at the same time, it was the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God that caused that event. They hated Jesus because of what he preached and because of what he said about his deity, what he said about the use of the temple. They hated Jesus, and they put him to death. A wicked thing. But that death was also part of the sovereign purposes of God. So my short answer for why did Joseph do this? Why did he contribute to this hostility? Well, remember, Joseph was speaking true things. He really did have these dreams. God really did plan to make Joseph, to exalt Joseph. And this is where it leads. Verse 23, it came to pass when Joseph was come unto his brethren that they stripped Joseph out of his coat, his coat of many colors that was on him, and they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty. There was no water in it. It may have been a well that they were digging or planning to dig, but they throw him down into the pit. Reuben leaves, apparently. He actually dissuades them from murdering Joseph. But then the other brothers decide to make some kind of profit out of this, and they're passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. And Reuben returned into the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. They kill an animal, they sprinkle blood on Joseph's coat, they take his coat to Joseph, tell him, took it to Jacob, Joseph's dead. And Jacob will live with that sorrow until he's reunited with Joseph later. But Joseph was sold into slavery. These are real places described in the Bible. Some of these sites are still being explored by archaeologists today, and some of them, of course, are modern cities continued from ancient times. And he returned to his brethren, Reuben, and said, the child is not, and I, whither shall I go? And they took Joseph's coat, and killed a kid of the coats, and dipped the coat in the blood, and they sent the coat of many colors. This coat has become the symbol of their hatred. And their anger is so great they won't even divide it up. And you know, one writer said they could have sold the coat to the Midianites. It probably had some value. But they hate Joseph so much they can't resist taking this coat dipped in blood and thrusting in Jacob's face and said, "Oh, bad news. Your favorite's dead." They brought their friends. "We found it." They lie. They conspire. Reuben, you know, for a brief moment you think, well, Reuben's going to rescue him. Reuben says nothing. Reuben doesn't confess and say, "Oh, I can't do this. We sold him to the Midianites." Joseph knew it and said, "It is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces." No search party. Could he be dying somewhere according to their lie? One of Jacob's faults also is that he is pessimistic. He tended to believe bad things. Later, just before Jacob dies, he tells Pharaoh, "In my life's been a few years, it's just been full of trouble, one bad thing after another." We look at Jacob's life. It's not quite true, Jacob. There's been a lot of good things in your life, but Jacob was pessimistic and, of course, overwhelmed by grief. Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days, and all his sons, hypocrites all, and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "For I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. And the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. Again, this is a very familiar narrative. It's unspeakable to us that their hatred could be so great. But we know, we don't see some of the drama because we already know where this is headed. We are biased by what happens later to Joseph. We say, "Don't worry, Joseph, it's going to be all right." We see Potiphar's name. We say, "Oh, yes, that's part of the plan. He's going to serve in Potiphar's house. He's going to rise to a chief executive, household manager. He's going to have a position of great trust and honor in Potiphar's household." Even there, we know trouble will arise. But we don't see the drama. We don't see the heartache. We don't see the pain that Jacob experiences. And maybe we don't really appreciate the depth of his brother's sins. The murder in their heart. The conspiracy to... It could have caused their father's death. He could have literally grieved himself to death over this. And they don't care. They're angry. They hate their brother. And they persist in this lie. And Joseph is sold into Egypt. There's a foreshadowing there too, because when Joseph moves his family to Egypt, they do not go to Egypt as slaves. When Jacob and, was it 75, I think, people, when the household moves to Egypt, they come as honored guests. They come as Joseph's household. They're given property in Goshen, and it's one of the most fertile spots in Egypt. And they arrive, and everyone ostensibly admires or loves Joseph, and they come into the prince regent's household. So when they move to Egypt, they're not sold, they're not slaves. They come as honored guests, maybe exalted guests. Problem later arises. There is a Pharaoh who doesn't know Joseph. So apparently, as long as the memory of Joseph was alive, as long as the testimony of Joseph was rehearsed in the ears of the Egyptians. And the story of the famine, the story of Joseph's stewardship, as long as they kept that history alive, why, the family of Joseph were honored guests. Well, we can't say enough what Joseph did for us. Boy, we would have all died. We would all starve. My grandpa told me stories about Joseph's storehouses and all he planned, and the 7 years of, and then 7 years of lean. And boy, that Joseph, he was an amazing. Did amazing things for us. But there will come a time when a new Pharaoh, will blot out the record. He'll say, I don't talk about Joseph anymore. Egypt begins with me. I've been Pharaoh here for 30,000 years. Nothing before me. Don't want to talk about why. There's nothing before me, so don't talk about Joseph. And he doesn't respect Joseph. And because the Israelites are becoming so numerous, reaching hundreds of thousands of people, they fear them. And they, because they're foreigners, because they are numerous and no doubt rich and wealthy and very prominent, and the Pharaoh rises and says, oh, I can't have this, and he enslaves the Israelites. So when we read these early days of Joseph, with memories of the encounter that he has with his brothers and the hostility, and we try to draw lessons from poor parenting from Jacob and all, but the fact of the matter is, it is interesting that it's these Bible narratives, which are true, we get to see the providence working through these events. We know where the narrative's going. I say that for a couple of reasons. We don't know that now, do we? We don't know that about our life. Now, sometimes you can look back on your life, your salvation experience, how you met your spouse, how God brought you to a certain place, or how God, you know, worked in your life. You can look back on your life and you can say, well, I see how God was working there. But the fact of the matter is, we really don't know. We can't see God's providence. It's not like a map to us. It's not like a GPS that we can say, well, I see now why God closed that door, opened that door, why God limited that life here and that appointment. And we're totally, I won't say totally, but we're very much in the dark about, where is this going? Where is my life going? What is my days? We don't know. We don't know how many days we have. We're not like God. We can't even number the hairs on our head. We don't know what a day brings forth. God does. And so my point is that just like we look at Joseph's life, we say, oh, his father messed up there. His brothers, oh, that was not good. And, oh, no, he's thrown into a pit. No, he sold as a slave. I know, and then, oh. But above that, we're sort of like the narrator. We say, it's going to be all right, Joseph. Why? We know what happens. We know where the story's going. We know, like, oh, that's how he gets to Egypt. Oh, yeah, you guys get thrown in prison. That's bad. But he gets promoted. You know, that dream business got him into trouble. But later on, the fact that he can interpret dreams, that'll come in handy. God will use that to get him out of prison, because he will interpret dreams. He'll interpret the baker and the butler, and then he'll interpret Pharaoh's dreams. So we say, well, you know, maybe he shouldn't have told his brothers about his dreams. But it's God's hand on him that we say, oh, that's how God gets him to Egypt. That's how God tests him and tries him. And that's how God proves to Joseph that his character is genuine. You know, it's a remarkable thing that I don't want to speak ill of any politicians, but to have the wealth of Egypt put into your hands, how do we know that you could trust Joseph with that? How do we know he wouldn't ship it offshore to some bank account? You know what Joseph did? He put it in storehouses. And when the people were hungry, when the Egyptians got hungry, They came to Joseph, and Joseph said, I'm ready. And the whole world was having a famine, and when other people came from other countries, they came to Egypt, they said, you know where it was? Joseph stored it for him. His integrity forged, you know, God proved his faithfulness to Joseph, and God demonstrates that Joseph was trustworthy. You can trust Joseph with your household. Trust him, you know, he did not touch anything in his master's household. He would not touch his master's wife. Pharaoh could trust him with the wealth of Egypt. And Joseph became a benefactor to probably millions of people. He doesn't seem to be lifted up with pride. He never loses his connection with God. Even the promise of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob for the land of Canaan, Joseph never becomes so bonded to Egypt that he says, well, there's no Sphinx built to Joseph. There's no, great temple or pyramid. You thought I wouldn't think of it. There's no pyramid. Why didn't they build a pyramid for Joseph? Certainly seems to be worthy. Well, there were some pharaohs that had something to say about that. But Joseph's heart was always in the promised land. He was the descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He said, when you leave, I know you're going to leave, take my bones with you. I love to compare and contrast how Joseph and Moses served God. One served God by going to Egypt. One served God by leaving Egypt. One served God by rising in Pharaoh's court. One served God by refusing to serve in Pharaoh's court. It's a wonderful, wonderful message there. What are some of the causes of tensions in modern families? Well, the same things that cause tension in ancient families. Partiality, pride. We're all sinners. Jealousy. Favoritism. Wealth can cause tension, and poverty can cause tension. Why did Joseph's dream make his brothers hate him? It's really pretty simple. He said, I'm going to be exalted above you. He was not the firstborn, by the way, which was a big thing in those days. He was not the firstborn. He was Rachel's firstborn physically, but he was not the firstborn son. As I said, he's not even the son through whom Christ comes. But he said, I will be exalted above you. In what ways can God turn our disasters into triumphs? God is so powerful, he can take any difficulty. And sometimes he uses physical disasters to teach us spiritual things. Sometimes he uses physical problems to deal with us spiritually. God is sovereign. He's able to overrule all things. What do you think kept Joseph true to the Lord during his trials? The Bible doesn't really say. It doesn't really exposit Joseph's faith. But the book of Hebrews makes it clear that he was a hero of faith. Joseph knew the true and living God.